You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome in hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, September 9th. My pleasure to be with you on this feast day of St. Peter Claver, priest from Spain, became a Jesuit in 1604 and left for Colombia in 1610 and dedicated himself to the service of black slaves. So St. Peter Claver, pray for us, especially as we continue to live amid racial tensions and difficulties and all the rest. St. Peter Claver, you who saw the dignity of every person, pray for us. Here in a little bit, I'm going to be talking with my friend Alyssa Wilkinson. Alyssa, who is a film critic. She has written for Christianity Today. She writes, she does a lot of freelance work. She writes for Rolling Stone. She's going to be leaving Christianity Today and starting with Vox, which is an online magazine. Always appreciate Alyssa's take on things through her own faith viewpoint, but, you know, has a great, what I call a sacramental imagination. And she, as an evangelical, she says she's trying to revive the evangelical imagination, but always a great perspective. I want to talk to her about an article she wrote a couple years ago in the in Christianity Today about movie lessons from the Church of Satan, of all things. Really, you know, I think challenges some of the assumptions we make of recognizing what is truly evil in the things that we see. Sometimes what's the word Jesus said? We strain at gnats and swallow camels. Sometimes the things we think are evil in cinema are really not as evil as some other things that are much more nuanced and much more of a temptation in shaping who we are. So we'll talk about that with Alyssa. Also get her take on the movie Sully. I know she wrote a review of that. And it sparks my question of the day, since we're going to be talking some about films. What's the best movie you've seen this year? Now, you can look at that either way you want, as a new movie that's been released this year, or a movie that maybe was produced in some prior year, but you had never seen before. We just heard Alan Alda, my guest last hour. If you missed that part of the program, you definitely want to check out the podcast. But Alan saying he just saw Mary Poppins for the first time. I can relate. My kids are still upset with me that there are a few Disney classics I have not seen. My wife watched all those with them, typically when she was a stay-at-home mom with them. A lot of them I didn't see. Or if I saw them as a kid, I forgot about them. So anyway, I could relate to what Alan said about Mary Poppins there. So you can pick whichever you want. Some responses we've gotten to this question on Facebook would be, let's see, Jill says Love and Friendship. Not familiar with that one. I need to look that one up. Mark says Ben-Hur, the remake. John Steven, best movie he's seen this year or best movie to come out in theaters this year. LOL, he says. Shannon says, I haven't been able to sit and stay awake through one in years. Shannon, I feel you. The last movie I saw, she said, was The Letters. This was, I think, about Mother Teresa and her dark night of the soul. And even that, as good as engaging as it was, she said, I had to watch in parts because a few moments after I sit in a chair, I automatically nod off. Yeah, my family is all big on this new theater feature at this one cinema in Lexington, that where they have these reclining seats, you know, with the footrest and all the rest. I'm like, please, I don't need any more encouragement to fall asleep in a film. I would be better off going to some rock hard concrete bench theater to watch a film. Honestly, I've become my father. I think I went over to a friend's house last year to watch The Man from U.N.C.L.E., sat down his recliner, and I literally, 5 minutes into the film, I was out cold. My son was with me, and my friend told my son, don't worry, don't wake him up. He needs the rest. So I woke up at the closing credits. Even in Bridge of Spies, which I saw the other night for the first time, which I really enjoyed, there were a couple of moments in the film that I was out. A lot of dialogue in the movie. So even though it was well done. So anyway, we'll see what you've got to say about that. Somebody else, as I said, chimed in with a favorite Finding Dory. Mary Lou says St. Vincent is favorite movie that she saw again this year. I've been wanting to see that. Bill Murray. I mean, what's not to love about Bill Murray, and evidently at least a implicit Catholic theme in the midst of that. So anyway, we would welcome your calls. 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Or you can post a response on Facebook or on Twitter, Mike Allen Show, the handle. Looking forward to later this afternoon, I get to go and help man the St. Paul Street Evangelization booth at our biggest church festival here in the Lexington, Kentucky area. Our cathedral has their annual Oktoberfest. Draws a huge crowd. It should be a nice, really, really nice evening. Hopefully it'll cool off a little bit. But, I've long been an advocate that parish festivals that usually draw from a pretty diverse crowd. I mean, who doesn't love coming and hearing some good music, eating some good festival food, throwing back a few brewskis, going to the blackjack table? I mean, there are all kind of opportunities at a parish festival. And we miss, it's really one of the most opportune encounters that we have in our parishes with people who are not Catholic. And we really miss an opportunity oftentimes to be a little bit more explicitly evangelistic in our outreach to them. I'm not talking about, beating people over the head or, shoving icons in their face or anything like that. But there is, I think, an innate curiosity out there from a lot of people about Catholicism. A lot of things that they don't know. And I think there are so many opportunities that we don't really put our entrepreneurial minds to work in terms of the creativity that we can have in exposing people not only to our festival as a fundraiser, but as an opportunity to engage people with the Catholic faith. And so the idea with St. Paul Street Evangelization is that, you go out to different places where there's a lot of foot traffic. And in this parish festival, there will be a lot of foot traffic. And it's a ministry of presence. You're there. We use this cardboard life-size stand-up of Pope Francis. People love to get their picture taken with it. It's so realistic, this stand-up. And so oftentimes it creates an opportunity for conversation. So I'll be manning the St. Paul Street Evangelization booth and looking forward to engaging folks in conversation or just simply having a prayer for someone. It's always cool, too, to do this in places that are not parish-related, just do it at large public events. People will talk to you. You'll be amazed. And a lot of times it's maybe the fallen away Catholic that you encounter. And maybe your ministry in that situation is simply to listen. Just listen. It's surprising. A lot of people think that to be a street evangelist means setting up a bullhorn and preaching a sermon. That's not it at all. Or they think even they have to be prepared as a master apologist to answer every question about the Catholic faith. And as the people who created this ministry, which now has branches in dioceses and in cities and in parishes, not just around the country, but even around the world, as they say, they quickly learned that when they were out being in this ministry of presence on the street, because people are not expecting to see Catholics out there like this, that they quickly learned that it really wasn't a ministry of argument, though there were occasionally those situations. It was a ministry of listening. We talked with Alan Alday about the attention that we pay to our children and really is a sign of the dignity of who they are. And we see in them the image of God and their value. It's no different. People want to be listened to. And oftentimes the most disarming thing you can do to someone who's got a beef with the church or criticism of the Catholic Church is just to listen. Just to listen. I've got a friend who's going to be doing this tonight for the first time. He said, what am I going to be doing at this street evangelization thing? And I said, hey, relax. It's pretty informal. It's really about a lot of listening. He said, this was a joke. He said, I'm brushing up on my Obadiah just in case. I don't think you'll probably get a lot of questions about Obadiah, which is an Old Testament book, by the way. Anyway, as I said, today, the feast day of St. Peter Claver, born of a distinguished family in Catalonia, Spain, in the late 1500s, joined the Society of Jesus, and after his novitiate, went to a particular college. There he met Brother Alphonse Rodriguez, who was also a saint. Again, this is a tendency in church history. Saints make saints. Alphonse set Peter's soul on fire to save the souls of the African slaves, thousands being lost because there was no one to minister to them. His superiors finally sent Peter to New Granada in April of 1610. He would never return to his native Spain. When he finished his studies and was ordained a priest in 1615, when he made his final vows, he added a personal one, I'm sure with the permission of his bishop. His final vows, he added a personal one. Peter, slave of the slaves forever. Here in this busy seaport city in a hot, humid, tropical climate, Father Claver spent most of his, where he spent most of his priestly life, there at the principal slave market for the New World. It was to those who were brought, kidnapped against their will, to be sold in such an inhumanity that Peter would minister. He would meet the slave ship as it arrives, would go and bring them food, water, medicine, and clothing. He brought them Christ. We'll be back in just a minute. St. Peter Claver, pray for us, with my friend Alyssa Wilkinson. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Friday, September 9th. Pleased to have with me via phone Alyssa Wilkinson. She is a New York City-based critic and a professor, wears many hats. She has written for Christianity Today, Rolling Stone, Vulture, RogerEbert.com, and has been a fixture at Christianity Today since 2013, but is going to be transitioning away from there and will be working now for the online a magazine, Vox. She's also an author. She's written a book, How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, and Politics at the End of the World, which she co-wrote with Robert Joustra. Came out this past May from Erdmann's, and currently at work on another book as well. She's also assistant professor of English and Humanities at the King's College in downtown Manhattan. Do you have time to sleep, Alyssa?
I will once the new job kicks in, I think.
Well, that's great. It's fascinating to me all the different things that you do, and I appreciate your outlook on film and your evangelical imagination, as you say.
Thanks.
You know, let me ask you a question real quick before we get into this fascinating article you wrote about the Church of Satan and all things. When you watch a film, you know, you obviously write reviews for a whole breadth of different publications. You know, you've written for Christianity Today, you've written for Rolling Stone, now you're going to be writing for Vox. When you watch a film, and does it affect how you watch it when you know what the type of publication is you're writing the review for?
Yeah, it probably affects it less than people expect, though. I get that question sometimes. I think that my philosophy about films is that a film that's good is good for an audience, and a film that isn't probably isn't good for any audience. And so, the job that a critic has is to figure out why the film is good or why it isn't, and be able to pin down and explain that. And so the challenge for me is always putting myself in the mind of whoever the reader is, because a typical reader of those publications is all very different, and figuring out what it is that will help them make a decision or help them understand the film better, no matter who they are. So I think that my process has a lot more to do with the voice that I'm writing in than it does for the film itself or for the argument itself. The argument usually stays pretty similar.
I read an interesting article. It was an interview actually on MTV the other day where somebody was an MTV writer, obviously a thoroughly secular in her perspective, was interviewing somebody for Focus on the Family who reviews films for them. And it was almost like she was the interviewer was surprised that Focus on the Family reviewer was watching all of these films that you would not think would be necessarily suitable for the typical Focus on the Family crowd, but almost surprised that this critic for Focus on the Family was actually pretty fair-minded and broad-minded. Do you think there's a typecast and a stereotyping, I guess, of film critics from a faith perspective?
Yeah, I think that's true, although I think it's pretty well deserved, honestly. I think that if you dig around for Christian reviews of things, you tend to find two genres mostly. One is the don't watch this genre, which is basically a recounting of everything that's objectionable content, and I put that in giant air quotes, that tells you why you shouldn't watch this. Or you find this genre that's like the gospel according to X, which is, whatever the hot thing is right now, we're going to find Jesus in the middle of it. I had just read one of those about Stranger Things, and I had written about Stranger Things myself, and I was like thinking, wow, this is, you almost lose the thing itself in trying to sort of bend or mold it into some kind of a Jesus story, which, you can find Jesus in anything, but let's also treat shows and movies as shows and movies with stories to tell that that their makers are interested in. So I think, what we do and actually what Plugged In does has always been a little different in that we're trying to think about the thing as a movie or as a TV show and, how it operates as that kind of a thing and not just as a parable. Because movies and TV shows are not parables. They operate like them in some ways, but they're not. They're a different thing altogether.
You kind of look at the film for its own sake, so to speak, instead of maybe through a more utilitarian kind of a lens.
That's right. Yeah, the film is not a tool. It's a film. And so we start there. How does it work as a piece of visual storytelling? And, and then maybe it does also tell, act as a tool or a metaphor. But if we only treat it as a metaphor, then we don't really learn to see things for what they are. And, it would be disrespectful to treat a person as simply a metaphor, right? So we wouldn't want to do that. And so it seems to me that treating a work of art as not a work of art, but just a metaphor or a tool is similarly not very respectful to the makers of things.
Well, that's a nice segue into this article that you wrote a couple of years ago for Christianity Today that I thought was pretty fascinating. Lessons from the Church of Satan. As you said at the beginning of the piece, today I read with interest an interview Gawker did about film with Peter Gilmore, High Priest of the Church of Satan. There's a sentence you never expected to read in Christianity Today. But one of the points you make early in this article is, I guess it's a reference to some other writing that you've done, in distinguishing between what you call a capital R and lowercase r religious film. So talk about that for just a minute.
Yeah, I had written a piece right before I read that interview about how why don't we talk about what we really mean when we say religious film? And I was thinking about the difference between a capital R and a lowercase r religious film. So a capital R, to me, a religious film would be one that is about religion, specifically organized religion, right? So, maybe it's a Bible movie, or maybe about Jesus or somebody, or maybe it's a movie about a church, or, a movie about whatever that might look like, about the struggles of a clergy person, but that to me is, you know, it's about religion. People would say, oh, this is a movie about Catholicism, or this is a movie about being a preacher in the South or something like that. But then there's this other kind of film that I'm really interested in, which is religious in nature, which is to say it's asking the same questions that religion seeks to answer. So questions about our origins or the purpose of life and the meaning of life, or, you know, what is sin and what is atonement. And these kinds of films exist in a much wider range, I think, and often have nothing to do with organized religion at all. But they might pull together, you know, the questions and sometimes the answers and sometimes not. And I think when people see a lowercase r religious film, they're left without, maybe without an answer, probably without an answer, a clear answer, but they're given sort of questions to ask, and they're left pondering those questions. So I mean, a very easy answer to this, which is kind of overdone by now, but would be something like The Matrix, which really does seek to ask a whole bunch of, you know, people talk about it as if it's philosophical questions, and there certainly are questions in there that are asked by philosophy, so you could say it's a philosophical movie, but there are also lots of questions in there that religions have sought to answer. And I think it's, you know, this is an important distinction because I don't know that I agree with people who say the world is becoming more secular, but I do agree with them that the world is becoming less rigid or less beholden to traditional religion in how people try to answer those questions. So as that happens, then it's important for us to think about how movies are shifting as well. And I think we see an abundance of religious movies, but not all of them are about religion, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, the human being by nature asks questions. We're incurably religious. And so we shouldn't be surprised that no matter how what the film, you know, what it's about, let's just say, I mean, those questions are going to emerge, and maybe great filmmaking leaves you with more questions than you had coming in.
Yeah, that's right. And we can add TV to this. This is actually kind of the topic of my next book. And I found myself writing about TV almost more than film because TV shows really have the space to turn those questions over and over and over and look at them from different angles, just by virtue of being longer. So I think that's important and interesting. And it became important when I started looking at these movies that the Church of Satan had picked as exemplary movies.
Yeah, and just to clarify, when we say Church of Satan, you know, people think that, I mean, by the Church of Satan's own definition, I guess, and they are an entity, it's not about worshiping, in their view, a demonic figure. It is more about the worship of self. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's right. They define themselves, you know, and academic people who study them also define them as not, they're basically anti-Christian. That's probably a better way of thinking about it. So everything, the person of Satan to them is not really a real figure at all. They might hold rituals, but those rituals are designed to basically just make fun of other religions. And so for them, the highest goal is a sort of narcissism, to develop a sort of perfect individualism, a perfect like regard for self without regard for others. It's less of a religion,
right,
and more of a philosophy in some ways, but they organize themselves.
Alyssa, we're going
to have support.
We got to go to a break. We'll be right back. We'll talk about what films they recommend and some lessons we can learn from that. Back with Alyssa Wilkinson. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show on this Friday, September 9th. Still here with Alyssa Wilkinson, who's a New York City-based film critic and a professor. She's also an author. Check out her book, How to Survive the Apocalypse, Zombies, Cylons, and Politics at the End of the World, which she co-wrote with Robert Joustra. Alyssa, thanks for holding on.
Good to be here.
Let's get back to this article that you wrote back in 2014, trying to refresh your memory on this a little bit, Lessons from the Church of Satan, which was, like you said, a surprising theme for an article in Christianity Today. As we already said, the Church of Satan, from their own definition, not about worshiping the demonic, but really more about the worship of self and the rejection of Christianity and maybe more of organized religion answers to the questions that human beings raise. And you said there were some expected films that were on their list of recommended movies, which, you know, Rosemary's Baby and some other type of things. But also there were some unexpected ones. All the King's Men, Blade Runner, even Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and Wise Blood, based on the Flannery O'Connor novel. And one of the things I got from reading your article was, you know, so many times, especially people of faith, I think we see the movies that are obviously that what we think are demonic or evil, you know, movies about possession or, you know, mocking the faith or whatever. But sometimes, you know, if we pay attention to what the Church of Satan recommends, maybe we'll recognize there are actually more subtle themes in cinema that we need to be aware of that that perhaps are more of a temptation than what seems like at the surface a stereotypically evil or satanic film.
Yeah, it's a funny list because they also acknowledge that, you know, of course Flannery O'Connor wasn't writing a satanic book in any sense, but they kind of look at them and say, well, you know, here are some things that we hold to that this movie also has characters who promote these, and so, you know, I think Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is kind of a great example, especially given that, you know, Willy Wonka himself, Gene Wilder, just passed away a couple weeks ago. You know, their perspective on that is, well, you know, it's a children's movie. It's, you know, it's harmless, perhaps. But also, you know, if we really look at it and we really think about it, this movie promotes the idea of some characters who, you know, who get what they want just by sort of, you know, sticking, you know, knowing what they want and then sticking with it. And you know, they're kind of out for themselves and they're out to sort of gain from their own, from their enemy's destruction and stuff like that. And, you know, oh, that's, you know, that's a narcissistic trait that we can really get behind. And this struck me as very funny, and especially because you can easily imagine a Christian review of the film that would come up with a different moral. But for me, it's fascinating to see how you can look through a particular lens at a movie and get something from it, depending on your perspective, and then how there's no easy way to say, oh, this movie is about, this is the moral of this movie. You know, you know, movies have different characters. They have different things going on inside of them. And, when we look at them, we come up with different ways of looking at them, depending on what our perspective is. And the Church of Satan did as well.
Yeah. You have some sort of takeaways, and I'll make sure I post a link to this on the show's Facebook page so that folks can read the article. A few takeaways. One is that, you know, a movie might not be Christian. I'm making air quotes there. A movie might not be Christian just because it portrays Christianity, and even if it portrays Christianity in a favorable light.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, to me, a Christian movie, a movie that is Christian, if we can say that, is one that perhaps looks at questions, religious questions, and tries to look at them from a Christian perspective, which I use very lightly because I think that often it's used as if it's obvious what that is, and I don't think it is. But it might be a movie that approaches those questions in a Christian way or attempts to sort of give a Christian cast to the answer. Whereas movies that are about Christianity or even ones that we might consider to be Christian in some way sometimes don't approach them in Christian ways at all. wind up sort of forming our imaginations in ways that aren't Christian in the least. And that's an interesting thing and something that I don't think Christians often think about, because if the studio or the filmmakers tell us, oh, this is a Christian movie, or if there's Christians in it and they're portrayed favorably, we might say, oh, okay, great, then we can watch this movie. And, then we just haven't learned to read or watch movies very well.
Yeah, I think about it. And I have not seen the film God's Not Dead, but wasn't there maybe a little bit of hint of sort of Schadenfreude in there in terms of the antagonist in the film sort of getting his comeuppance?
Oh yeah, he literally is killed at the end of the film. I mean, it's a revenge fantasy. It's pretty interesting when you actually look at it as think of it more in the context of a sports movie or a kind of revenge movie. And, it is capitalizing on a feeling maybe that Christians have that they're downtrodden or that people are sneering at them, from these vaunted points in the academy or in politics or whatever. But, the Christian response to that is not to take revenge on your enemy. Obviously, the Christian response is the exact opposite. And the movie seems a little more interested, to my eyes anyhow, in making its viewers feel some sense of, revenge or fulfillment than it does in helping us remember that we are called to love our enemies unreservedly, no matter what they do to us, even if they try to take away our rights or make fun of us.
Hmm. You also make the point that Satanism is not just for Satanists.
That's right. Yeah, and I mean, Satanists would tell you this, too. You don't have to be a member of the Church of Satan to be a Satanist because of the way, at least the way they've defined it. If you're out for yourself, if you are goal number one, or if your team winning is goal number one, then you are conforming to the teachings of the Church of Satan, whether or not you recognize it. And the movie can be that way as well, whether or not it kind of comes out of the gate and is like, hey, look at me, I'm a Satanist movie. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is not, I don't suggest you don't watch the movie. I think it's perfectly fun and interesting, but they see it as a Satanist movie without it being about Satan in any way. Or you'd have to sort of turn backflips in order to say, oh, this movie's actually about Satan. And it wouldn't be very good backflips, but you can see, once you kind of understand how they look at it, why they would call it that.
Well, that's a little bit of the irony. Despite whatever the Church of Satan's protestations, I mean, from the Christian perspective, Satan would be perfectly content if you occupied yourself with the worship of self, because, I mean, he is the personification of that, non servium, I will not serve. So,
yep.
that's the essence. And so maybe we sometimes miss the obvious, the way, because the truth is we all are tempted to be Satanists in that sense. I mean, our whole life is a journey of allowing God to uproot that in us, and so we have to be very careful that we don't whatever strain in a gnat and swallow a camel. We understand there are many ways that we worship the self, and that we can allow films to tap into that in ways we wouldn't expect.
Yep, that's exactly right. And that film can teach us to worship the self. That perhaps is something we need to not run away from in fear, but counteract. So, every children's movie for decades taught children that, the highest goal was to be yourself and don't let anyone tell you who you are and, follow your dreams. And it's like, well, maybe there's more to it than that. But if that's the primary goal that we're trying to teach children through movie after movie after movie, then they might wind up being Satanists in a sense.
Mm. Very good. So I'm going to post a link to this. I want to real quick, get your opinion. We only got about a little over a minute and a half left. You've seen Sully. You recommend it?
I do. I really liked it. In fact, it's sort of an anti-Satanist film, if you want to call it that. It sort of extols in a very subtle way, the virtues of community coming together to solve crises instead of the way we treat heroes, which is to turn them into celebrities. And I, you know, I did not expect to love this movie at all, but I really did end up liking it a lot. And it's a very tense movie in some places, of course. It has Tom Hanks, so for a lot of people, that's enough. And it's just a very solid retelling of that story, as well as the fallout from what happens after something like landing a plane on the Hudson, saving all the lives, ends there. It begins right after that and looks at what Sully Sullenberger was experiencing.
Yeah, well, you got Tom Hanks, and I guess Clint Eastwood directed it.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, and I mean, Clint Eastwood is very interested in masculinity and heroism, and I think this, you know, he's hit or miss for me, but this story, I think, is a perfect match for him, and Tom Hanks is the only person I can possibly imagine playing a character like this in all of American movie stars, and he nails it.
Yeah,
but at the end of the day, it's about heroism and ordinary heroism instead of celebrity heroism.
Alyssa, it's always a pleasure. There's always more things I want to talk to you about than we have time. I guess that's the sign of a good interview. So thanks and blessings to you. Happy belated anniversary, and we'll talk again, hopefully.
Thank you.
Good luck with the new gig with Vox. This will be. We'll be back in just a minute. We'll spin the Dalek Catechism wheel. This is the Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media. Want to learn more about Breadbox Media? Just go to breadboxmedia.com, and you can learn more about our various contributors. We really have a whole stable full of folks. Very appropriate analogy, since we're broadcasting from horse country. But excellent people, both in terms of daily shows and folks who have shows on the weekend. We have people literally in every corner of this country and across the heartland, different temperaments, different perspectives. But, you know, that word Catholic means universal. So within that big tent, all through the lens of the Catholic faith, which is pretty cool, really. And there's no other, I don't think, media enterprise out there doing what we're trying to do. And that is to accompany each other, really, to a deeper knowledge of Jesus and his love and his goodness and his grace and the truth and the beauty of the Catholic faith. You know, to the church he founded upon St. Peter and the Apostles. We try to do that through Breadbox Media. Your support and your interest, you're spreading the word about what we're doing, telling people about our programs. Sharing the podcasts, all the things that you can do, becoming a friend of your favorite show, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, hint, hint, through monthly support. You can get access to exclusive online content. You can even subscribe to our podcast through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean. You can check it all out. I really enjoy talking with Alyssa Wilkinson. I tease her a little bit and say, you know, she sounds like a Catholic, even though I know she's an evangelical. And she says she's just trying to revive the evangelical imagination. So I can appreciate that for sure. But I think she does bring a great imagination to her writing. It's sad that Christianity Today is losing her work, because I think she really brought a depth of artistic insight into that publication. So continue to follow her work on Vox. And as I told her, when she gives a positive review, she's one of those few critics out there. It makes me want to see a film. So I definitely want to go see Sully. And she's also written some favorable things about the Netflix show Stranger Things, which I have yet to see, but I want to see. So anyway, I'm asking a question in terms of what's the best film you've seen this year? It could either be a new film that you'd never, you know, that just came out this year, or it could be a film that maybe it was an old one that you had not seen, but finally found the time to watch it. So if you want to chime in on that, you can call or email 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. I think I just posted on the show's Facebook page a direct link to that 2014 article about the movie Lessons from the Church of Satan, because as she says in the article, really, you know, Satanism is not just for Satanists. And, you know, a lot of times we think about what are the obviously evil films out there that we want to decry, you know, whether it's some sort of a demonic film that glorifies the evil one, whether it is a film of great decadence, for example, like a Magic Mike or a 50 Shades of Grey and so forth. And I'm not saying that, you know, that people of faith do not have legitimate reasons sometimes for being critical of films or for avoiding certain films. Absolutely. You have to practice custody of the eyes and think about the things that shape and mold your soul. But I think Alyssa does a great job of reminding us that, you know, sometimes, you know, Satan's not dumb, okay? I mean, he loses in the end, but he's going to take some folks with him, or desires to, for sure. And so his assault is not going to be a full frontal one. There are ways, subtle means through which narcissistic themes or films that shape and form us in a way that are actually the ways that are more hostile to Christianity, more hostile to a life of self-giving love, for example, that then maybe we notice sometimes, and they kind of creep in even under films that have the guise of being a Christian or religious one. So I think a lot of food for thought there from my friend Alyssa Wilkinson. So again, and you can check out her work as well, alyssawilkinson.com, including her book that came out on the politics and the apocalypse. Very, very interesting indeed. The 500th anniversary of the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation, I guess all depends on the lens that you're looking at it with, right? The 500th anniversary coming up in 2017, on October 31st of 2016. So really starting the, I guess you could say, the 500th anniversary year. It was in October 31st, at least according to sort of popular understanding, October 31st, 1517, that Martin Luther, the Augustinian brother and priest, nailed his 95 theses in protest there on the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg. And so we're coming up on the 500th anniversary of what Protestants call the Reformation, and I guess from a Catholic perspective, it's more like a revolt. But interestingly enough, on October 31st of this year in Lund, Sweden, Pope Francis will take part in a commemoration of this 500th anniversary. As it says here in the Christian Century, an article here by Michael Root, that a pope would participate in a commemoration of Luther's posting of his 95 theses is a sign of how far ecumenical relations have come. But the path to commemoration has had its bumps, and the event is significant both for what it is and what it isn't. Earlier commemorations of 1517 were exclusively Protestant and often strongly anti-Catholic. Imagine that. Talks began in 2007 between the Lutheran World Federation and the Vatican about how the 2017 anniversary might be genuinely ecumenical. And the International Catholic Lutheran Dialogue took up the question and in 2013 produced a document, from conflict to Communion, which provides background for the joint commemoration. This booklet, From Conflict to Communion, tells the early history of the Reformation in a way that both Lutherans and Catholics can find accurate, without attempting to justify one side or the other, with a clear apprehension of the mistakes on both sides that blocked reconciliation. And then, I mean, Catholics can readily admit, I mean, there were mistakes made on both sides. I mean, the way that I've seen it really explained, a guy by the name of Carl Adam wrote a book, The Truth, I think, The Truth of the Reformation or something, that said, you know, if Luther had been content only with reforming the church, because the Catholic Church is always reforming and being reformed, always, because we are a collection of sinners. God's providence and grace is at work in the church for sure, preserving truth. But there are a lot of areas in which we need to be reformed and renewed. If Luther had been content with that, he would be revered today as one of our great saints, maybe another Boniface, maybe along with Boniface, a patron of Germany. But somewhere along the line, from the Catholic perspective, Luther moved from reform to revolt, to a rejection, really, of the idea of the church. And it's that tearing of the fabric of the Christian faith in the West that we are noting the 500th anniversary of. From the Catholic perspective, it is not a celebration and cannot be a celebration. And I hope that it will provoke among Protestants, beginning with Lutherans, a reflection on what the purpose of the Reformation even was about. Because many of the things, most of the things Luther protested are not even issues in the Catholic Church anymore. So was the Reformation an end in itself? Or was it a means to an end? And if it's a means to an end, perhaps Protestants need to reflect more thoroughly on what the end goal of that is. Not a separate track of a church, but coming back, bringing you know, your own particular patrimony with you, but coming into communion and experiencing the unity for which Christ prayed and for which Christ died. Anyway, we'll get into that more a little bit later, I think, next week. Let's spin up the Dollar Catechism wheel in the time we've got left. Paragraph between 1 and 2865. We've dialed up 760. Let's see what 760 has to say. Truth, of course, never random, always integrated within the panoramic totality of the truth. 760, the church foreshadowed from the world's beginning. Christians of the first century said the world was created for the sake of the church. That's first Tertullian, who said that. God created the world for the sake of communion with his divine life, a communion brought about by the convocation of men in Christ. And this convocation is the church. The church is the goal of all things. And God permitted such painful upheavals as the angels' fall and man's sin only as the occasions and means for displaying all the power of his arm and the whole measure of the love he wanted to give the world. Wow, that's a power-packed paragraph right there. The world was created for the sake of the church. And we're talking about Reformation. What is the end game? It's that we might all be one in union with the God who is one. Three persons, one God, drawing us into communion with himself. Oh, Lord, overcome our sinful divisions. May your unity may find perfection in us. We'll be back. Hope a great weekend. We'll be back with you Monday. This is the Mike Allen Show.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.